Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
So, how you doing there, Reg? What's you up to? What's you up to? What's new, pussycat? That's a reference you have no idea, do you? No, you wouldn't know that. It's Tom Jones. That's Woody Allen. Forget about it. Whatever. Look it up. Google that. That every comment I make, Reggie, most of the time, every reference I make ends with the phrase, Google that. Because after a certain point, a certain age group does not know what I'm even referring to most of the time. Most of the time. One of my favorite Bob Dylan songs. Anyway, okay, are you ready to get go here? Ready to, are we going to a go? Okay, let's go. I'll give you the three S's. I'll give you the countdown. I'll give you the music. I'll give you podcast number 430. We love podcasts with a zero or a five at the end. This is 430. 430. Okay. All right. Here we go. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Whoa. We didn't time it right. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Pod. Whoa, now it's Jim. What's going on? Yeah, you can't. Okay. All right. So hit it right after I finish it. I guess you can't give it that lead like you usually. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Every time. Last time, whatever it does, it does. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and rate this podcast, but most of all, don't forget to get out there and promote this podcast. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that you have found this podcast to be informative, entertainment, the ultimate revelation. And you want to spread the good word. We'll spread that good word and let people know that this podcast is the place to be. Of course, if you like this podcast, not only should you get out there and spread the word, not only should you listen to it every week, but you should also listen to it and any free time you have. Because we have past episodes that are just waiting for you to either discover for the first time or rediscover. These podcasts are rerunnable. You can always go back and listen to a podcast from the past. In fact, it's always a good idea. Let you know where we were so you know where we're going. This is episode number 430. I should mention, I sort of went long on that, but you go to WGNRadio.com and you hit the podcast section, and then you hit this podcast section, and that's where you find all those past podcasts. So do yourself a favor, and if you need some content to fill your open hours, whether you're just relaxing, whether you're in a car, long car drive, wherever you're at, this podcast, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, always a very good audio companion for wherever you're doing or wherever you're going. I did mention there that sometimes it's good to listen to where we've been so you know where we're going. I guess this podcast will fill that bill to some extent. A few podcasts ago, I was talking about the Democratic Convention, which will be held this week in Chicago. This podcast posts on the opening day of the Democratic National Convention, which will be held here in Chicago, is being held here in Chicago. I guess I should talk about it in the present tense, even though I'm recording this a couple of days before, but I will talk about it in the present tense since you are hearing it for the first time on the date of the convention or after it, so it's present tense. But yes, this August 19th, 2024, for 4 days, the 19th, 20th, 21st, and 22nd, at the United Center here in Chicago, will be the Democratic National Convention. Chicago, from what I understand, I'm pretty sure this is a true statement. I saw this. I didn't write it down, but I believe that not only is Chicago have the record for holding the most presidential conventions, but I believe the number was like 32. And if you think there's only one of these every 4 years, that's a pretty good record. I'm sure that Chicago was chosen for more of a geographical choice than anything else, because it's in the middle of the country, a major transportation hub because of that. It was also a major city, so it had a big venue or venues to hold such a big event with delegates coming from all over the country. It would make sense to converge in a centrally located area that's easy for everyone to get to from the West Coast, from the East Coast, from the North, from the South. So Chicago, and that's basically one of the reasons why Chicago emerged as a major city, was because of its location. And so it's not surprising, but Chicago certainly has a great history of hosting political conventions. And, you know, back many decades ago, going through the years, hundreds of years, you know, things weren't like they are today. Everything is so competitive. Things were, you can argue, I mean, once again, I'm not saying things were better at all, because they weren't. Things have never been better. There's never been a better time. We like to glamorize the past when we're sitting in the middle of something that's a little chaotic, and that's most of the time in human existence. And so we like to look back on the past, and we do some selective editing many times. And when we think back of those misty watercolor memories, as Barbara Streisand so aptly put it, we tend to either edit out or certainly obscure or certainly downplay whatever negatives we're talking about, and elevate the high points and the memories and the good things that we think about a certain time or certain era, in order to give us a little temporary moment of either stress relief or or just some nice memories, right? That's what that song Evergreen was all about. And so we tend to forget some of the bad times. So I'm not in any way, you know, doing one of those, in my day, things were better. There's never been any good old days. One person's good old day is another person's horrible day. That's just the way it is. But we do tend to try to glamorize, if you will, the past in many ways. But when you start to dig down deep into the details, you go, well, maybe it wasn't. But we don't like to do that. Ultimately, we are an optimistic race of or species. And so we tend to always try to look on the bright side, which is great. But many times it helps to obscure some problems that we have. And that's why many of the problems that we have remain, because we obscure them. But yeah, so my point is that back in you know, many days ago, it was like, okay, look, Chicago is a good central location, and so we'll just have the conventions there every year. You know, it worked last time. Let's do it again there this time. And check mark. We're off to the races. Now we have one less thing to worry about. Things were much easier back then. Not saying they were better, but there was much more kind of, well, this is the way we do things, and we just do them. And as I said, that's not always the best way. The current way is not always the best way. But that's the way we tend to fall into you know, routines. And so I think one of the reasons why Chicago probably held so many conventions is that not only was it centrally located, which was a practical matter, but then it was kind of like, well, it was okay there last time, and so we know what we get. We know they can handle the crowds of people with hotels. We know they can handle the transportation of people coming from all parts of the country. We know they can hold the crowd when they get there. In terms of venues, it worked before, it'll work again, and let's do it there, and let's get one check mark done in putting together this event. Now, today's world, much more complex, much more gray area. Back in those days, things were right and wrong, black and white. It was yes and no. And today, things are much more grayer. And so, in many ways, and so now there's more competition between cities. Having a convention there, having kind of any kind of either international or national event helps bring attention to a city or a region, helps bring tourist dollars with hotels and transportation and entertainment fees, and people are spending money. So even though ultimately many of these big events lose money, when the tallies are all kind of calculated year or so after an event happens like that, when all the real numbers come in and they go, yeah, well, I guess we did lose a couple of million dollars on that. But once again, you talk about our species. We are very oriented in short-term gratification. We rarely look down the road. We are concerned with today, right now. Is my belly full? Are my needs met? And so we tend to look at the present, not the future very much. And so at a time when this event happens, oh, it's fantastic. Oh, everybody's attention is on our city or our country. And we put on this big party. And like, look at the recent Olympics in Paris. I mean, Paris is on display. We can look at it from a tourism standpoint. I mean, Paris was pretty much on display for the last 2 weeks. And so now you know that people that have never been to Paris, or people who have been to Paris and maybe haven't been there in a long time, they're looking at the scenery and at the coverage, and they're showing the city at night, and they're showing the Eiffel Tower, and they're showing streets and cafes, and so some people say, maybe, wow, I've never been to Paris, or it's been a while since I've been to Paris, or I just love Paris. And you can't beat that. I mean, that's why they're putting those events on. Those events are kind of twofold. They're trying to bring attention to their city, but they're also trying to lure you there for any kind of event that gets a cut, at least, you know, not only just a one-day event, like even, say, the Super Bowl or something like that, which still, because you've got so many eyes watching that, and, you know, there's the hype before that. So once again, you know, for a week or so, that city's name is in the public arena. People are talking about it. I mean, for instance, once again, the Paris Olympics. They didn't even say, I don't know what number Olympic it was. I mean, if you really want it to be precise, it should have been the 32nd Olympics or the 100th. I don't know what number this was of the Summer Olympics, but that's the way it should have been billed. But if you listened to them talk about it, if you saw the logos, if you saw it on your program guide on your television, it said the 2024 Paris Olympics. That's the way it was billed. It wasn't the 85th Olympiad. I don't even know what number it was. I saw it on my program guide for 2 weeks. I watched a little of it off and on, not much. But still, I don't know what number it is, and I have a pretty good memory when I see something like that. I don't know what number Olympiad it was. That's the way it should have been billed, but no. Paris paid a lot of money for that to be called Paris Olympics. If you saw the press conferences, it said Paris 2024. The closing ceremonies had the handoff of the torch, and we already know that the next Summer Olympics in 2028 is going to be where? Billy, can you answer that question? Mary, how about you? Right, Los Angeles. We know that. They are going to be called the Los Angeles Olympics. So this is big stuff. This is big business. This is big bragging rights. This is, you know, a chance to show off. And so any kind of event, huge event that's going to draw either national or international attention, any city in any country is vying for it. There's always a big competition for the Olympics, and certainly here in the United States, when there was the planning for the conventions, it's a 2 or 3 year process before it even happens. Chicago had to, I believe, it was initially it formally was awarded the Olympics in April of 2023. So about a year and a half before. And certainly the submission deadline to enter the sweepstakes as to which city would get it. There were several cities, I think, that were up for consideration. And then they narrowed that down. I believe the last three or four was like Chicago, New York, Houston. I'm not sure if there was another one in there. But yeah, like I said, this is not only a potential. It's not so much, it's more of a revenue generator for the moment. As I said, you're going to get an influx of money from this event that keeps things in motion in your city. Hotel, transportation, entertainment. You know, those dollars come into the city through taxes. Airline tickets, train tickets, gas taxes, hotel taxes, restaurant taxes, shows, whatever people, when they're, you know, whether, you know, for instance, here in the Chicago area now for this convention, people will be here for 4 days for the convention, but they may come and stay, they may come 2 or 3 days before the convention, or they may stay 2 or 3 days after. So they're going to need to go out to dinner. They're going to extend their hotel stays. They might see a show. They might go to a baseball game. They might go to a concert. Who knows what? The money is spent. Now, ultimately, is this event, when you start to do the itemized listing of what it costs to put on this event, will that event have made or lost money? Most likely it will lose money. But in the short term, it will bring people to the city and keep it moving. It will bring in short-term money and keep Ubers and cabs going and things like that, and hotels. So there'll be a lot of hustle and bustle in the city. So that's why cities vie for it. As I said, then, if there is a long-term advantage, it's great public relations. It's great tourism exposure. You know, for the next 3 or 4 days, if you watch the convention, you will show these, you know, coming in and out of commercials, there will be these beautiful, hazy, you know, starlit and illuminated shots of downtown Chicago. I'm sure you will have stories about pizza and hot dogs and architecture. And once again, it will provide not only a backdrop to host the main event of the Democratic Convention, but it will also have a valuable tourist aspect to it for the city. Oh, I've never been to Chicago. Looks pretty. Looks nice. Maybe I'll go there on a vacation someday. Oh, that's cool. So there's an advantage of it. As an event, as we know, I said the Olympics, historically, cities that host it, it's a loss leader. You know, that's what they call, you know, when you go to the grocery store. I used to work at the Jewel when I was in high school. You know, when you get that, when you see the sales, like what's the sale this week? And you'll say, my gosh, you know, bananas are on sale for, you know, 29 cents a pound. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go there. Well, those are called loss leaders. Stores will choose products that they can afford to have lower than a regular price, which they know are popular and that many people buy on a weekly basis, or if they go to the store twice a week, and so, or even more than that, regardless. But so they put items on sale that are popular items. They put them on sale to get you to the store. So sure, yeah, you go there, they may lose some money on that sale item, but now they've got you in the store and now you're going to spend money on other things. And so the key is to get you into their store as opposed into anyone else's store. So that's why the grapes are suddenly on sale for 79 cents or the cherries are on sale, you know, or something like that. A lot of times it's food, a lot of times it's fruit, in order to get you in. Those are called loss leaders. And so that's really what an event like this is. It's kind of a loss leader because the event itself is probably going to lose money. But as I said, it can perhaps, hopefully, a city hopes, if the event goes well, that it can lead to long-term advantages, not even from the standpoint of people on television watching the images of Chicago and saying, oh, it looks like a pretty city, maybe I'll go there. But in the terms of this convention, even the delegates, some of these delegates that are coming to Chicago or are in Chicago right now for the convention, they may have never been here before. And maybe they're only here for the 3 or 4 days of the convention. They'll leave, but they'll say, wow, you know what? I had a real good time. I was very busy at the convention, so I'm going to come back. Anything you can do from a municipality, from any city, any region, whatever you can do to get people in and experience it, can have long-term advantages for people to say, hey, I'd like to come back here again. But the immediate is certainly the event. The long-term, it's hard to calculate that. You know, when they start to do the postmortem on this convention this week, they will say, oh, the convention brought in, you know, $500 million for the 4 days. And that's a very impressive number. And that justifies all the expenses that had to be. They can calculate that, you know, that they'll get that number out there, how much money convention brought to the local economy. That number you will hear soon after it, because there needs to be a justification for this. After all, there's some, you know, public money being spent. So you'll hear that number. Oh, you know, hey, it was worth, yes, there was a lot of traffic. Yes, there was a lot of Street closures, yes, there was a lot of inconvenience, but we helped our local economy here in Chicago and around the Chicagoland area because people came in, they spent money at hotels, I said before, blah, blah, blah. So they'll have that number. Oh, it brought in 500, I don't know what the number will be, 200 million, you know. Oh, hey, that's great, you say. What you don't hear is when they really do the final accounting on it. It's like, well, yeah, okay, it brought in 500 million. That's true. That's a verifiable number. But rarely do they say, but at the end of the, and if they do, it's usually 2 or 3 years later after the event is gone and it's out of people's minds. We have short-term memory. And so you'll hear in a year or two after this convention is gone. Oh, by the way, the 2024 Democratic convention lost, $3 million or, $2 million or something. Now, once again, a lot of that money, if there is a shortfall, there's a lot of expensive, wealthy donors. Because once again, it's prestige to have it in your city. If you're a big business person, if you're a big macher in the political world, you sort of want to, have this event in your city because you get to play hosts, you get to go to all the cool parties. I mean, this is all schmoozy stuff. If you're into the schmooze culture, this is, a Democratic or a political convention in your city is one of the ultimate schmoozes, right? So you, not only is there a beneficial advantage to an event like this in a city because of the monetary advantages, but at the end of the day, once again, people are people. This is all about schmoozing. This is all about acting cool, acting important. This is my city. Oh, we got to go to this restaurant. This is my, they know me there. Okay. I mean, this, believe me, I've been around people that have been in the political world, and it is very, very sleazy in that way. People love to be there, to be seen, to be cool. And so a lot of this, yes, is, outwardly, yeah. Oh yeah, this is going to be a great economic boom to the city. Believe me, you will see, if you pay attention, you will start to see these numbers in the next couple of days about the economic boom that this event is bringing to Chicago. You will see those numbers, no question about that. They will be reported and they will be touted, and the people that put this convention together will be bragging about those. But also, this is about, oh, this is going to be cool. I get to walk around. I get to go to the VIP parties. I get to go sit in the VIP suites. I get to go to my favorite restaurants and be comped. I mean, that's, at the end of the day, that's who we are, right? We mask it in all this. Oh, we're helping to elect the next president of the United States. Yeah, you just want to do this because you get to go to the cool parties and sit with the cool people. Let's be honest. We get older, but we never grow up. It's just like high school. It's just like grammar school. It's who's behind the velvet rope. It's who's in the cool crowd. That's all it is. It always ever been. As I said, we get older, but we never really grow up. We're pretty much stunted at a maturity level of about 10. Let's be honest. But yeah, so anyway, Chicago was granted this, and so here we are. It's a big event. The last convention here in Chicago was in 1996. When President Clinton was nominated for his second term. And I have to tell you, in terms of what that convention did for Chicago, in terms not only of the possible economic benefits of just pure revenue coming in from people spending and traveling here, as I said before, but in 1996, you could see, and that's almost 30 years ago now, you could see the benefits that event had in Chicago. It was held at the United Center. In 1996, the area around the United Center was a very impoverished area. It was a dangerous area, high crime, high poverty, low income area. The stadium, the United Center, a great magnet for people to come, but people went to events and then quickly left. It was a dangerous area. It was very poverty stricken, as I said, and low income. It was not like the Wrigley Field Disneyland area there, where you hang around and go to bars and things like that. You went to an event and you went and you left. So when the Democratic convention in 96 was coming, the city knew once again, you got to put your best foot forward here. And so at least as much as it could do, it decided to, it had to clean up. There were a lot of abandoned buildings. There were a lot of open, abandoned lots with garbage. It was a distressed area. And let's be honest. It was. Just have to be honest about it. It was a very distressed area on the west side there. And but if you're gonna throw a party, if you're gonna invite people over, this is what I said before in a couple of other podcasts ago. You know, is Chicago ready to hold this event? Are we ready? Chicago right now, its reputation is not great around the country. The reputation is a very crime filled city, one of the biggest crime statistics in the country. Back then, it wasn't so much crime. It was, as I said, a kind of a distressed area, a poverty-stricken area. And so the city and the state said, well, we've got to at least, you know, clean this up. We've got to make our house look good if we're having a party. And the main arteries, the main streets leading to the United Center is Madison Street and other cross streets, but basically it's Madison, you know, or the surrounding area, Randolph, Halsted, areas around there, Damon, things like that, streets that cut it on the west side near Rush Presbyterian Hospital there. So, you know, around Racine and Damon, Ashland, Morgan, those streets there, that little neighborhood, that area. And so that was going to be where a lot of the delegates from around the country were going to be coming down these streets and staying in these areas and driving down these streets. And so obviously, like when you sell a house, as I said before, if you sell a house, you clean it up. You make it look spanking new. You make it look great. When people walk in, they say, wow, this is nice. And so Chicago made sure that at least the major arteries of where the delegates were going to be driving into and seeing, not only were safe, but they also were appealing. And so a lot of these abandoned buildings and a lot of these empty lots that were eyesores were cleaned up. And the whole area there. Now you could look at this and say this is a very cynical thing, you know, like they're just slapping, you know, new paint on a problem, and that's true. At the time, that was true, and I don't know if they were relocating people. I don't know what went on, but all I know is in 96 when the convention was there, the surrounding area around the United Center was cleaned up and it looked new. There was new paint on things. Let's put it that way. It may have been temporary at the time, but it was cleaned up. But here's an interesting thing. Now, you can argue on gentrification, and there are major arguments on that. Yes, gentrification and the changing and renovation of a neighborhood is good in terms of rental properties and once again taxes and businesses starting, as opposed to being in distressed areas where that's not the case. But you could say, then where do these people that live in these areas go? Yes, you have this influx. If all of a sudden the neighborhood starts to get bustling and there's new construction of apartments and then new businesses open up to serve those people, and suddenly there's parks and there's people walking their dogs, and you say, wow, look at this. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, this was almost a condemned area, and now it's a hustling and bustling area. That's true. But then the other side of that argument is, but where did the people that were there go? Where did they go? Their lives didn't suddenly get better where they can afford to live in those areas. So where did they go? And that's the argument against gentrification. That's what you heard several years ago when they're building it. It'll be done in a few years, I assume. You know, the Obama Presidential Library, which will be here on the Chicago area on the South Side. And while it was like, oh my gosh, this is great, a presidential library in Chicago? My God, you know, once again, tourism, prestige, all that stuff. But there was a lot of opposition to that project. And from, I mean, you know, Barack Obama, the country's first African-American president, a lot of African-American people and a lot of African-American groups fought, if not against it, to not have it done. They certainly wanted concessions to say, wait a minute. Yeah, this is great, but you're knocking out, you know, to build this, you're going to displace many people who've lived in this area. This is their neighborhood. Where are they going to go? There's always a push and pull. As I said, if you look at the pure evolution of this, by cleaning up that area, by investing the money that was needed and the attention, which sadly, yes, I'm conceding, if that convention hadn't come, why, if you had that money to clean it up for the convention, why couldn't you have put that money and that effort to clean up that area for the people that originally lived there? But once again, the reason was because there's this big economic potential pie or this pot of gold at the end of the day here. I'm investing this money to clean up this area because this event is going to bring me $500 million. So I could spend $100 million to clean this up because I'm going to make $200 or $300 million, at least on paper. That's the justification. In the other scenario, I'm going to spend $200 million to clean up this area, and there's no economic benefit for me to make that money back. That's money that will just be spent and go away. Can we afford to spend that much money in one area? So the argument is, well, we could, because in this one area, there's going to be this event that's going to draw perhaps twice as much money for the economy to pay for that. But it's still, in reality, it displaced people. Now the area surrounding the United Center on the west side, especially Madison and Randolph and Halsted, the Fulton Market area, booming, bustling, hottest, coolest, hippest places to be or lived or go to in terms of restaurants, in terms of nightlife, in terms of apartments to live there. 35 years ago, before, you know, say in the early 90s, you didn't, at night, you didn't see anybody walking their dogs at 11 o'clock on Madison Street. You do now. Now, as I said, the people that lived there at the time, they still have economic needs. I don't know where they went. I wish we would know when we have these big gentrification projects that happen, what happens to the people that are replaced in those neighborhoods? Because when they build new construction and new apartments and new businesses, they're aimed at a higher economic level consumer with $2,000 or $3,000 a month rents as opposed to $500. The people that live in the neighborhoods can't afford to live in those places anymore. So where do they go? I don't know. But there's no question that because of that economic or that investment to clean up the area surrounding the United Center for the 1996 Democratic Convention, there's no question that acted as an impetus to gentrify that area surrounding the United Center and going a little more toward downtown. The Fulton Market area, that was all industrial, and they were close, and it was not only industrial, but it was all old warehouses that were just abandoned with, you know, manufacturing companies that had been there 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, that those businesses were out of business and those factories just sat there. Now they've been converted into loft apartments or knocked down and built into apartments and office buildings. We've got McDonald's, one of the biggest companies in the world. Their headquarters are in the Fulton Market area. I think Google is going to be there soon. All of the development on the west side around the United Center, that whole Randolph Street area, which is now all booming with bars and restaurants, and that's where you go. You did not go down Randolph 35 years ago with that same kind of sense of fun or security. It was a very depressed area. Now it is booming. As I said, now the question is, where did those people go? I don't know. They had to go somewhere. So there's always a downside. And hopefully, when these people are relocated, hopefully there is some assistance for them. But in terms of creating an economic boon, once again, in terms of taxes, now here's an area that was depressed, that was not generating a lot of tax, property tax, business tax, entertainment tax. Now it is. We've got people living in apartment buildings, going into the local coffee shop, going to the local diner. That area around, there's people that are living there today that have no idea. They're in their mid to late 20s or 30s. They have no idea that when they were born, that area did not always look like that. And it was not always this kind of cool, hip, walk our golden labs down the street at five, you know, at eight in the morning and go get a coffee. It wasn't like that. The Democratic Convention in Chicago helped start that gentrification of that area. So you can look at it two ways. It was a good thing for the moment, as I said before. The short term, Chicago's hosting the convention. And in this case, it certainly helped to create a much lively and once again, revenue generating area that did not exist before. So there could be some long term possibilities as well. At the same time, you look at some of these countries that have hosted the Olympics, and they, once again, they spend billions of dollars to build new stadiums and everything. And then once the Olympics leave, those buildings sit there. I've been to some towns like Montreal and cities that have had Olympics, and you see, oh, that's where they had, and it's an abandoned arena. Nothing ever happened. When the party left, the party left. And those cities and those regions and those countries were left with a lot of debt, and they didn't have the ability to say, okay, well, now we've got this new stadium, so now we could do things with it. Well, they didn't have the economic foundation to continue that. They spent all that money. They may have made some money. They most likely lost money. And then you wound up just seeing abandoned structures there. remnants of an Olympics, remnants of a big an event that was a singular event. It didn't have the same kind of impact, like I said, say this 1996 convention, where it put a spotlight on that area. We've got to clean that up. We've got guests coming. We've got to clean the house. And once they cleaned up the house, they said, "Well, wait a minute. This area here is very beneficial. It's close to downtown. People that live downtown that are making a good wage, they might want to live in this area. Wait a minute. Maybe we can do something." So then private investors start buying up some of these buildings, knocking down the existing buildings, building new apartment complexes. As I said before, then businesses follow, because if you've got people living in there, then they're going to need services. They're going to need food. They're going to need restaurants. They're going to need grocery stores. They're going to need coffee shops. They're going to need nail shops. They're going to need clothing stores. They're going to need whatever. And that's the way you build a neighborhood, a thriving neighborhood. As I've said many times, the people that are living right now in Wrigleyville don't realize that 40 years ago, 45 years ago, for instance, the area surrounding Wrigley Field, once again, was a very dangerous, distressed area. There were no bars in 1980 around, no big hipster cool bars like you see now. There was no Restaurant Row and Bar Row 44 years ago. 1980, no way. That did not exist. Wrigley Field was in a middle class, lower middle class neighborhood that had a crime problem. It was a very small business neighborhood. Lower middle class, was not affluent with all the yuppies and all the young people and all the bars and all the restaurants. Not even close. 44 years ago, once again, you went to a Cub game and you went home. So there certainly are advantages to having a venue or an event like that. Now, in Chicago's history, not only can it brag about, hey, we have hosted the most conventions of any city in the country. Great. But Chicago also has a very major convention reputation, which supersedes any of the positives. The most hosted, and we've, hosted the most future presidents. Whatever you can do to spin the positivity of Chicago being this host of political conventions for either party, you can try as you may, but you will never erase the violent debacle that is a part of Chicago history and a part of American history that happened right here in Chicago in 1968 at the Democratic Convention, right around this time, about a week or so later or so. It was later in August. But 1968, so what's that, 56 years ago? And it's an indelible mark, it's an indelible scar on the city. And that's one reason why Chicago, it racked up those numbers about being the city with the most hosting the most conventions. Chicago racked up those numbers many years before. Chicago, this is only the second convention since 1968 here in Chicago. There was more than 30 before 1968, and there's only been two since 1968, two in the last 56 years, because of the reputation that Chicago had, because of the violence and the clash between protesters and police, and there's nothing to say except ultimate chaos and disorder civil disorder on both sides between protesters and police. It's one of the black marks in our country's history, and it happened right here in Chicago during a political convention, which is why Chicago has had a black mark on its reputation to hold conventions here since 68. And it's one reason why Chicago has always tried to help its reputation. It's one reason why Chicago wanted to host this one. Because Chicago is in this, as I said before, right now Chicago has got a bad reputation for crime. And so Chicago wants to put its best foot forward for tourism and economic investment and corporate investment and things like that. But there's no way that you can ever have a convention here without the memory of 1968. It was a perfect storm. And it was an imperfect storm. It was a perfect storm for chaos, and it was an imperfect storm for behavior on all sides. You have to, once again, you have to take a look at the realities of what was happening at that time in 1968. Leading up to that convention, and then at the convention itself. And that's why, hopefully, the goal here is, once again, Chicago can never erase what happened. It's a part of the history. The footage still exists. It's difficult to watch. I wasn't aware of it. I was alive, but I had no idea of what was going on. I was too young. But I certainly am aware of it, being a fan of history. And it's the images are so violent and so hard to watch that it's scary to think that was only 56 years ago, where that's the way we were acting. And that's the kind of country we lived in. There was great polarization. There was great divisiveness. Sound familiar? Hopefully Chicago this time with this convention, which does have its risks and does have its issues. Not so much so as perhaps it would have if President Biden was still in the race. Now there's this great sense of optimism and euphoria in the Democratic Party with Biden off the ticket and Kamala Harris running now against Donald Trump. But it doesn't stop the fact that there will be protests at this convention. We already know that many groups have applied for permits to march and protest. So that's always going to be a concern whenever Chicago hosts a convention. Now, in the next 100 years, 1968 will always be brought up. Even if it's 100 years ago, it will still be brought up because of the debacle, because of the pure chaos and pure violence, police brutality, as well as protester brutality. You can't take one without the other. It's easy, when you see the footage, it's certainly easy to say that the police were at fault. And I'm not saying that they weren't, because they had the billy clubs, and they were attacking, and the protesters were unarmed. But it was such a volatile time. You can't just look at it and then blame somebody. We are quick to judge in this world today. We always have been. And that's why, if you don't know anything, I'd like to just give a sense as to why did this happen and can it happen today? Because, like I said, hopefully Chicago can make history with this convention as opposed to repeat history. But you can't look at the Democratic Convention 1968 without looking at it through the prism of the times. The 60s, 67, 68, We are in the midst of Vietnam. We are right in the middle of the hippie yippie flower power generation. Don't forget, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album came out in 1967, which is looked at as something of the ground zero for the peace and love and hippie flower child movement. The Summer of Love was 1967. It was the rise and the legitimacy and the mainstream exposure of the counterculture. The counterculture had always been there, but the Beatles had become such a flashpoint of a generation gap. And as they continued to evolve and get popular, they really helped move the culture with their fans, and they drew people in. You cannot downplay the influence that the Beatles had. A lot of people say, well, I don't think the Beatles are that great of a band, and but well, we can debate their musical advantages, but you cannot debate or deny the cultural influence that the Beatles had at that time. They really were the leaders of the counterculture, the leaders of the young generation, and that's where the divisiveness. Today we have political, there's always been political divisiveness, but in the 60s it was really cultural, and it still is to some extent, because politics and culture today have meshed. But it was a culture, it was a generation gap between the establishment of what was right and what was wrong and the way things always were and the way things should be, and the younger generation for the first time that had numbers, pure numbers, because of the baby boom after World War II, who had the numbers in their population, in their age group, to force change, or at least at the very least, to voice their complaints with the status quo in a loud and decisive manner. And so that's where the clash was. It was a cultural generation gap that did play into politics as well. So in 1967 and 68, there was this major development. Don't forget, if you look at the baby boomer generation, which really, you know, is called the baby boomer because of the return of the soldiers after World War II in 1945, and this huge population growth. Once again, we are sexual beings, right? the birth rates were low during the war, obviously, but when the soldiers came back, the birth rates jumped, and that's the baby boom. So if you say 1945 or 1946, 1947, when soldiers come home from the war, they get jobs, and suddenly the economy is booming and people are getting married and they're having kids, well, let's say 18, 19, or 20 years old, puts you in about 1967, 1968. About 18 to 19, 20 years after the war ended, those babies that were born were now young adults. They were high school graduates going into college, and they had the numbers to make their voices heard for the first time. The youth culture was putting its foot into the national discussion. That hadn't happened before. Before the baby boom generation, most cultures, especially in the United States, were adult driven. And the late 60s, the youth culture, the counterculture, whatever you want to call it, started to make itself known and heard. And the reason they did was because they had the numbers to back them up. Because that generation had a huge amount of births. Because the soldiers came home and they had kids. It's that simple, folks. It's biology. But so generation gaps have always existed. You can listen, you can read Aristotle, and he's complaining about the youth. The difference was, in this situation, the youth had the numbers. They could actually mobilize. They had the numbers to have their differing views put forth. There's always been a generation gap as long as man has existed. But it never had the numbers, never had the clout. This was the first time they had the numbers and the clout, and they used it. And they had an issue, mostly. Yeah, I mean, you know, kids always rebel against their parents, but there was also this thing called the Vietnam War, in which 18 to 20-year-old men were being sent over, and they were sent into a great abyss. And many of them did not come back. And those who were in that age group didn't want to get sent to Vietnam. They knew many of their high school and grammar school friends who did go and were drafted at 18 never came home again. This is about self. Yes, there was a humanistic motivation, a war that we shouldn't have been in. We're trying to, empire build, all the political issues surrounding the United States involvement in Vietnam were all valid. But one of the real reasons that so many young people, especially young men, protested against the war was not as altruistic as they may have made it seem. They wanted to make it seem like America was you know, they were finding problems in America, and they were talking about freedom and democracy and high morals and all these big platitudes. But you cannot deny that one of the things that motivated these 18 to 20-year-old men was they didn't want to go to war. They didn't want to die. They wanted to live their life. It was pure survival. It was pure selfish survival. I don't want to get drafted. I don't want to go to the war. I don't want to risk my life. I saw my friends either get killed or come back, you know, with permanent injuries. I don't want that to happen to me. Yes, there were these altruistic political platitudes that were being, but yes, that was part of it. But you cannot dismiss the fact that it was pure self-survival. I don't want to get drafted and get killed in the war, whether it was a important war or not. And that was a change. Don't forget, when we were bombed in Pearl Harbor in 1941, there were guys that were 15 that went that begged to be allowed in. You were supposed to be 18. They were 15, 16, 17, and they just wanted to go to war and fight. A completely different mindset 20 years later. Now, you could argue that it was also a different motivation. Once again, this was a war that seemed more about ideologies than real threats. Which made the Vietnam War such a quagmire on many, many levels. But once again, so when you're looking at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, you have to take into account what was happening at the day. It's not fair to take people out of their time and judge them by future standards. Is which we always do. That's why this culture, this cancel culture, is ridiculous, because it's not taking in account the era and the time that people were living in. You can't take people out of their own time.
if it was wrong, we acknowledge that, and we should be happy that we have moved from that. But you can't take a single person out of their era and say what you did was wrong, because that's the way life was at the time. It's not fair. But you have to know what was happening as to why this convention and this riot took place. In 1968, August is when the convention was here in Chicago at the Universal Amphitheater on the South Side, which is, it's gone now, the actual venue. But in 1968, in April, Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? This is about 5 months before the convention. Martin Luther King is assassinated. This great civil rights African-American leader, this inspirational figure, is assassinated. He held many hopes and dreams for an entire race of people here in this country and around the world. Brutally assassinated in Memphis. The aftermath were riots. There were neighborhoods burned in anger. It was a very turbulent time. Just 2 or 3 months after that, once that calms down to some extent, the pain and the sorrow and the anger didn't leave, but at least the outward anger and the riots and the burnings of neighborhoods and cities calmed down. Robert F. Kennedy, who's running for president in the 1968 election, of which the convention was going to be held here in August, is assassinated in Los Angeles just 2 or 3 months before the 1968 convention. Robert Kennedy, once again, was a huge presence and influence on the younger generation. He was a younger guy. The yippies and the hippies and the young people looked and they saw themselves the same way that the younger generation saw themselves in John Kennedy in 1960. The youth culture saw Robert Kennedy as their guy. Lyndon Johnson was an older man. He decided not to run, to seek a second term, which he had the right to do because he filled John F. Kennedy's remainder, and then he would get 2 terms himself. So Johnson won in 64. He finished out JFK's term from 63 to 64, and then he won his own and in 64, and then he could run in 68. But the Vietnam War was so turbulent and so controversial, and it was such a political, as I said before, an abyss in so many levels, that he decided not to run, which was a huge decision. Ironically, mirroring what just happened now. A sitting president available for another term, like President Biden, but decides to step down and not seek a second term. That's not heard of. Most incumbents always run for a second term. So you had Martin Luther King being assassinated in April. You had Robert Kennedy being assassinated in June. You had the sitting president before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, obviously, announcing he would not run. More turbulence. And you had the Vietnam War, which was this major generational event that was splitting the older generation and the youth culture. The older generation always looked at America wins wars, America fights wars, and America wins wars. So if the government and the president says we're going to war, we go to war. And the young people of that era said, no, this is not a war. Nobody attacked us. You all went to war in World War II because we got attacked at Pearl Harbor. Okay, we'll give you that. But nobody's attacking America here. We're invading a country, basically. We're fighting a Cold War against Russia and this ideological war against communism and the domino effect and all these things. This is not the same. We're going into wars for different reasons now. We're going in there for ideologies, not for attacks. We have to rethink our war mindset. That's what the youth culture against the Vietnam War was saying. We can't just go to war and show our muscle because we can. There's got to be a reason for it. And they didn't believe that there was enough reason for us to get involved in a war where so many Americans were fighting for an abstract goal. There was a very clear goal in World War II. We were attacked at Pearl Harbor, and Adolf Hitler was on the verge of world domination. That was a real threat. This was a esoteric threat, a theoretical threat, that if communism this, if, there were too many ifs. And that's where the divide was. The older generation still felt the same way. We go to war, do we win wars? And the younger people is like, no, we shouldn't just go to war because we go to war. So you had so many polarizing and divisive issues happening. Race, civil rights, with the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the hope and the optimism that he brought to the African-American culture here in the country. Then you had the assassination of Robert Kennedy, who had the hopes and optimisms of many people, not just young people, but other people who were tired of the turbulence of that was happening in this country. And he provided a new outlook, an optimistic outlook. And then he was assassinated. All this under the umbrella of this, what many people thought was a very unjust war. And those and many other, and then you had this counterculture. You had people with long hair and smoking pot and taking LSD and wearing sandals and getting into these Eastern religions and burning incense and the hippie yippy thing. And the older generation didn't know what the hell was going on. So you had so many political and cultural polarizing things that happened all at the same time leading up to this August convention. And so it was almost inevitable that something was going to boil over. And at the time, Chicago's mayor, who was a very, old school, gruff, law and order guy, Richard J. Daley, he wasn't going to put up with any kind of this monkey business from these hippies in my city. And so you had a police force that was not respected because the young people were rebelling against any kind of establishment. Don't forget, at that time in the 60s, police were called pigs. There was a great rebellion against anything establishment. So that meant the government, that meant the police, anything like that. And we're seeing that today. Just a few years ago, there was a whole movement to defund the police because of the George Floyd incident. And you saw the riots that went on during that time and the police under a stress. I'm not giving anybody a free pass here. I'm just saying that there were a lot of volatile, emotional, stressful events that were all, as I said earlier, a perfect storm. They were all bubbling over. And then Chicago was the seat for all this. for all this turbulence, all this anger and rebellion and sadness and injustice and indignation. It was all ready to go. And it was aimed at the Democratic Party because Lyndon Johnson was a Democrat. And most of the hippies and the yippies were Democrats, but they didn't want this kind of a Democratic Party. That was the irony. This was infighting. This wasn't Republicans against Democrats. This was Democrats and liberals against each other. But then you had the law and order, which was viewed as more conservative, of a police force. Well, long story short, it started to bubble over. And there was a lot of tension at the beginning, a huge influx. You know, this was before Woodstock, really, but this is where the baby boomer generation, this is where the hippie and the yippie generation showed their force, showed their numbers, showed the power of their numbers by converging on Chicago, holding protests, which ultimately became violent. It's pretty much argued that you know, there was the taunts and everything at of the protesters calling the police pigs and throwing things at them. And finally, human emotions took over whether there were orders to stand down or not. It became a very ugly and violent evening in Chicago, in Grant Park. And as I said, all you have to do is go on YouTube and put 1968 convention and you'll see it. And it was broadcast all over the world. And Chicago, as I said, has had a black mark on it ever since because of the way the police here, because of the way that Mayor Daley here handled things. And yes, that the way the protesters also acted. There's blood on everybody's hands. But the sad part was that the visuals certainly show that the police were armed with billy clubs, and most of the protesters just had signs about peace. So the visual, and I've said many times on this podcast, we are a visual animal. The visual was unforgettable. You cannot unsee that when you see it. And that's the image that Chicago, at least for a convention, has to live with. It happened on Chicago's watch. And so here we are now in 2024, and we've got some possibilities of demonstrations and protests that could get out of hand. Yes, there's a new optimism and a new euphoria in the Democratic Party about Kamala Harris, because Joe Biden was considered too old and out of touch to beat Donald Trump. But there is still infighting in the Democratic Party. There are still groups within the Democratic Party who are not happy with the way the Democratic Party has been, and this administration, of which Kamala Harris is a part, obviously, as vice president, has run things. And so here we are again. We've got high inflation. The wars that are going on are not involving America, but certainly involves American involvement in terms of aid and money being spent and arms being given. They are foreign wars, Israel against Hamas, Ukraine against Russia. So we had an assassination attempt on a presidential candidate and former president, even though it wasn't a Democrat. So we've got economic uncertainty and instability, which happened in which occurred in 1968. We had an unpopular president who decided not to run, which we've had in 2024. Joe Biden decides to step down. We are involved in foreign wars that many people feel we are unjustly helping, especially those people who are pro-Palestinian and believe that we are involved in genocide by supporting Israel. So not the same as Vietnam, but still involved with a controversy about our entanglements in wars around the country. So a lot of the same societal and political issues that happened 56 years ago that boiled and bubbled over here at the Democratic Convention in Chicago and led to a horrible riot, violent riot, many of those same ingredients are converging now on Chicago 56 years later again. Today is the first day. No one has any idea what's going to happen between today and Thursday. This could be a very peaceful and optimistic and event-free, scandal-free event. But there is potential for possibilities. Not to completely recreate and completely mirror what happened in 68, but any hint of police brutality against any kind of protesters, and there are going to be protesters here in Chicago, they're here, we know that, they've got routes where they're going to, if there's any, there could be a firestorm, and the images of 68 will be broadcast all over television. Even if there's a small scuffle, those images from 68 will come right back. Believe me, the media have those images waiting in case anything happens. So as I said before, Chicago's already had some challenges with its crime rate to begin with. Now we're going to add protesters from around the country, if not the world, protesting against the war in Gaza, protesting perhaps societal things, inflation, who knows? But there is a lot of dissension within, as much as there is euphoria in the Democratic Party, there's a lot of dissension within the Democratic Party, the same way it was. Does it have the same ingredients for violence? Maybe not, but you never know. We don't know. Human behavior. We're living in a tinderbox right now. And so it's hard to predict. No one knows. Today is the first day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We have memories of 68. And we hopefully will that are awful and terrible and regretful and painful. All we could do is hope that our memories of the 2024 Chicago Convention are more positive. As I said before, hopefully with this convention, Chicago can make history rather than repeat it. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 430. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.